Der Triathlon Show 414. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview David Lippmann. Dave's background and experience across many different realms is quite fascinating, so I'll just leave it to his introduction to actually talk about that. But long story short, him and I first connected a couple of years ago, and as Dave is somebody with his finger on the pulse of a lot of things in science and practice of endurance sports, I thought that we should just turn one of our off-air chats into an on-air podcast, which is what we've tried to do here with a number of different topics that we felt would be interesting and relevant to discuss. So we'll get right into that after thanking our sponsors, Form. The Form smart swim goggles give you real-time feedback in your swim training right on the goggle lens, including splits, pace, stroke rate, and heart rate. This means that you can execute your swim workouts better and get a better idea of your ability to hold certain paces and stroke rates and understand when and why you start to slow down. The best thing is that you can see and interpret this data in real time in the session, so it's actually actionable and can help you right then and there. Also, it adds more fun and engagement to swim training, which might make you look forward to your swim sessions in a completely different way than before. You can get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency even when you're short on time. It is a great tool for busy athletes because you can do a quality workout in just 15 minutes at home, even on days when you don't have time to get to the pool. And it is a perfect complement to pool and open water swimming as it allows you to focus specifically on key aspects of your swimming like your catch and your power and isolate them more easily than you can in the water. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back and you can get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now without any further ado, let's get into the interview with David Lippmann. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Dave. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you, Michael. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Can you start by giving us an introduction to yourself?
Just this is a tough one. I get asked this a bit. I guess my background, I started in exercise physiology. I did an exercise physiology degree and then a podiatry degree with that. You know, coached a bunch during that time and, you know, coached my first sport when I was 17 and sort of progressed through that. Ended up going into medicine through a sports medicine route. I was working as a doctor for a while. And then, yeah, moved countries, for my wife, did all those things. And yeah, now I live in London, despite the accent, and yeah, work in tech, do some podcasting. And I sort of consider myself a bit of a specialist generalist when asked. And I sort of sit in that space between health and performance, I guess. That's kind of the area I like to occupy.
So I'm going to ask you to go into some more specifics there. So let's start with the podcast. What are the podcasts that you're involved in?
So I work in tech for a company called Super Sapiens. It's a sort of continuous glucose monitor company for athletes. And I produce and host their podcast. And then in addition to that, I do a podcast with Matt Fox from Sweat Elite. I think he's a previous guest of yours.
Yeah.
And we do that on running. So it's called Pro Running News. And then I've got another little other project that I can't mention exactly what it is yet, but around December, it should be in public. And I'd say that your fans are probably... we'll hear that podcast, recognize my voice and be like, oh, that's the project he was talking about. So I can't say too much more than that.
Well, that's exciting stuff. We'll keep tabs on that for sure. And yeah, in terms of your own athletic, but not background, but what you're currently up to, you're running a lot.
Yeah, I guess. So I ran track in high school, loved it, was never really that good. I was sort of trying to be a middle distance runner. Wasn't that good. I finished school. My coach stopped coaching. I got into working as a strength and conditioning coach. And so I got into lifting heavy things. And, you know, you're an 18-year-old, 17-year-old male. So that's what you do. Ended up doing quite a bit of that, competing in some Olympic weightlifting. Again, not great as an athlete, but enjoyed it. I did a little bit of powerlifting for a while, found my way back to running. And then, you know, as a 20-something-year-old, started running a little bit longer distances, half marathons, marathons. So I was doing a lot of trail running when I was living in Australia. And then when I moved to the Netherlands, I started running a bit more road stuff and then kept going with that. Ended up running, you know, some of the majors, Boston, Berlin, London, etc. And then, yeah, moved to London and trying to get back into a bit more trail running now. But yeah, run some ultras on trail. I run many of the marathons and trying to get faster, I guess.
And when you say that you're working in the intersection of health and performance, how did you end up there? What is the path that took you? Because as a medical doctor, what led you to not work directly in medicine as a doctor, but working tech and so on? And can you just talk a little bit more about that path?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess I started in performance. So I was working as a sports coach, strength and conditioning coach, and was heavily leaning that way. And I got some good advice from a mentor of mine who said, listen, you need to make yourself in community level sport, especially in Australia, there's not a lot of budget. So the more indispensable you can make yourself, the better off you'll be. So go upskill in different areas. So, you know, if they have to travel with only one person, if you've got multiple skills, you'll be the one they take. So I started doing some sort of first aid, sports medicine stuff on the side, which then led me down the route of more and more medical stuff. And look, I was studying podiatry as well, so it was in that field, but ended up getting heavily involved with Sports Medicine Australia, entering medicine and practicing as a doctor for a while. And I was working clinically, to be honest, and sort of had half stepped out of coaching, but was still interested in still coaching a couple athletes on the side, friends of mine, and writing my own programs. I've been self-coached for the majority of my career, if you can call it that when you're not very good. But, and then I guess when I moved to the Netherlands, I had the option to keep practicing medicine, but decided against it because it was very difficult from a language standpoint. Ironically, I speak Dutch. It's just not quite good enough. It would need to be professional competency. So then started looking for other things, got back into some coaching. And then I guess when I started working in tech and thinking about myself more and more, it's kind of like, well, where is your skill set lie? And I have interest in both performance and health. So then you naturally find a niche that suits you, I guess. So that's kind of why I describe myself that way, and where most of the projects I'm working on sit somewhere in that space, I guess.
But the projects you're working on are mostly with various tech companies, maybe other companies, but not so much coaching individual athletes or people at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, coaching, I probably love problem solving more than anything. So the writing of the program, solving of that problem is great. The execution of it and the support, I don't know if I give enough to. Like I get very involved in coaching and really if I'm going to take somebody on properly and they're going to pay me and we're going to engage in a proper relationship, like that's a lot of commitment. And I'm not really in a space to do that at the moment. I don't think I'm the best person for that a lot. I'm happy to give people thoughts, advice, consult, those sort of things, but and then solve those problems. And that's where I get really excited. And then the execution of it is less exciting to me. It's probably why I stepped out of strength and conditioning, was that on the ground coaching in the gym, I enjoyed that interaction with the people, but I found it, the mechanics of it, a little bit boring versus the writing of the program, which I love. So I kind of, that's probably why I'm not coaching as much as I could. But look, I've got a couple of friends who ask opinions, some people who I give advice to, some people who come with questions, and some people who I, you know, give big picture programming to. I've got a friend who's recently started half marathoning, for instance, and it's like, all right, well, here's the rough stuff you should be doing. And he'll send me a couple of texts every now and again, and I respond to him. But he's an exercise physiologist, so the level of input he needs is pretty low. He just needs some running specific advice through a lens he understands. So that's kind of where I'm at with it. I mean, you and I have talked off air a little bit about, you know, some training stuff and given some thoughts, and that's probably the extent of what I do for most people at the best. Not claiming any of your success, by the way, because it's been impressive and not to do with me.
No, but I was going to say that, yeah, definitely you're somebody that I feel like if I wanted an opinion on something, one of the people that I reach out to, and it's always really good to chat.
I think that's a really good point for people who are self-coached, like is have a group of people you can bounce ideas off, because it's something that I've definitely felt value in for myself. There's a handful of people I would reach out to and ask questions of in a similar vein, which is if you are self-coached, you need someone to bounce ideas off. So have a group of people you trust and you can ask questions of, and be there for other people if you are a coach, I recommend.
Yeah, no, 100%. So let's dive into the first topic for today, other than the introduction, which is something you actually did an episode of on Pro Running News. And it's a recent publication that was published by a big group of authors. I think it must have been 15 authors or more,
yeah,
potentially. The Evolution of World-Class Endurance Training, The Scientist's View on Current and Future Trends. Eivind Sandbach was the first author on that paper, but there are many recognizable names there. So yeah, can we start by discussing that one, as you have done a full episode on it. I'll let you just give the listeners a brief overview of what it entailed.
I guess they interviewed a bunch of sports scientists, coaches, and sort of asked what they thought what had changed in the last 10 to 15 years, and then potential forecasting about what's going to change in the next handful of years, the next 5 years or so. And I think it's just a really cool way to do it, is to get not one person's thoughts, but getting a group and then trying to find some consensus in there. Because, I mean, that's how I try and find, I guess, I don't want to call it truth, but perhaps signal in some of the noise in a lot of things I do, be it a recipe that I'm cooking is, let's go find five people who cook this, find what they all do the same, find what they do differently, you know, find the things that are common and different, and then make some decisions between that. And I think it's a cool way to solve this problem, which is what's actually changing, not what is this person changing. And they, you know, they find a handful of things. I think the sport-specific demand stuff, so better understanding of that, was big for me, because I think that really resonated with me in my lens of being a strength and conditioning coach and having this, what's the end in mind, and let's really specify towards that. I guess they also said sort of better understanding of sport-specific demands, which is pretty similar. They talked about improved competition execution, and I think we're seeing this through a mix of things, be it travel, constraints of the actual event, so understanding what Tokyo Olympics was going to bring from a heat, time zone, all those things, not just how do I compete well once, but how do I do that over multiple days. The larger training loads, that sort of hinted at as well, so larger, more specific training loads, and I think probably the easiest way to explain that is in three words, is the Norwegian system, so to speak, and your listeners would be familiar, which is just how do we increase training load and how do we quantify training load better. Improved training quality is something else they mentioned, and that's a funny one, because I think probably that hinges on a better understanding of what you're trying to achieve more than anything else. And then I guess a more professional, healthier lifestyle. I think that's probably true ongoing. I think we're probably at the limit of that, where we'll see the improvement in that now. I think if you look back 30 or 40 years, we'd say that's for sure, right? And you saw sports people smoking at halftime or whatever. And then that evolves a little bit and they maybe stop smoking at halftime and now it's just post-game. And then all of a sudden it becomes, okay, yeah, now we don't smoke because we're athletes, and now our diet's a concern, and now we're sleeping. And I think we're probably at a rough ceiling for that stuff, because I think, to speak a little bit to the sort of space between health and performance, we're probably at a place where some of the stuff we're doing from a performance standpoint is not healthy. We're optimizing health outside of that, but now some of the stuff we're doing is not healthy. And perhaps diet is the easiest one here, as you know, Michael Phelps is a classic example of all of the pizza he ate or whatever because of the caloric density he needed. So at that point, yes, the swimming is as a concept healthy, but the diet required to sustain it is not healthy, right? So I think that's probably sort of the ceiling we're at. So those are the trends they sort of highlighted in the last 10 to 15 years. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that and what you've seen from your point of view, given that's probably, it's right in your coaching realm, right? And yeah, you're very much in this.
I think the training quality that you mentioned is an interesting one, and it kind of blends into the higher training loads, because it doesn't mean training harder, doing more intervals. It means understanding, as you say, kind of understanding what the goals are, and the goals would often be more consistently sustainable, but you want to make the larger training loads more sustainable in many cases. So the training quality kind of falls into that. So it actually often means, I mean, the Norwegian system is one example of that, which entails just maybe not doing as much high intensity, but being very specific with the intensity they're doing in order for them to be able to do high quality training day in, day out, and with really high volumes. Like, they're not doing polarized training where like 80% of the training is low intensity necessarily. They're doing a lot of work in that kind of threshold zone between LT1 and LT2. So yeah. So that's an interesting one that I see from a coaching perspective, and it also can align in triathlon. It very often does in long distance triathlon with understanding the race specific demands. And so if you're an elite athlete and you're training for Ironman or half Ironman or Olympic distance, they're all in that LT1 to LT2 area. So that's, and many, of course, many other endurance events are also fall in that. There are some that are not, like the shorter distances on the track and swimming and so on. But those are a few things that come to mind for me, or came to mind for me when I looked into this paper, and that, yeah, made sense to me basically.
Yeah. And I think, like, the elephant in the room is, you know, the influence of technology in general on those aspects probably facilitates many of them, right? You can better characterize what's required when you have better insights. So 10 to 15 years probably isn't long enough to say that's around the time of GPS watches becoming ubiquitous, but I think it's there or thereabouts, maybe 2008. I mean, I got my first GPS watch in, I think, 2010, 2011. So, you know, it's there or thereabouts when people started to be able to better quantify what they were doing, be it that their 10-mile run became more like a 14-kilometer run, and so they understood that better, or whether it was that, you know, they understood their actual pace now or something like that. So, and heart rate as well, I guess, within that and overlaying that data set. I mean, that stuff is so ubiquitous these days. There's almost nobody who's not using one of those watches, even, you know, a sort of so-called hobby jogger or something like this would have some variety of GPS watch. Maybe it's an Apple Watch or whatever, but just understanding the impact that has in terms of quantifying of loads, understanding of constraints, and being able to progress, right? Even from a motivational standpoint is pretty big.
Yeah, yeah. And I think some of the other things that you mentioned there with better race execution in terms of everything around it and so on, those are definitely at the highest level things that are already done really, really well. But equally, I feel that maybe some of those areas are, and health, like just thinking about something like sleep, if you go to the layer of athletes just slightly below the top athletes, that's where you find larger discrepancies, with some doing it really, really well. And for some, it's more of an afterthought. So I think that those are areas that, I mean, if we look back in 10, 15 years from now, maybe all of the athletes that are, let's say, of that sub-world-class level will also be doing really, really well, because otherwise they just won't be at that level anymore. It will be required. But now I still feel like there's some variation there, even at a fairly high level.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like F1, where there's like a trickle-down sort of effect. And I think, you know, the ability to spread information and ideas is significant. And, you know, it's something that this podcast is a good example, right? Think about the content you've got on this podcast and who you've got speaking to people. Those researchers, for the most part, are inaccessible to the average athlete and their advices as well. And it helps the researchers to get their research out, because that's ultimately what they want to do. But it helps the athlete as well and the coach. So I think that can't be discounted as part of the evolution here, as well as the ability to spread information, share it, learn from each other, learn from other people's mistakes. So I think we're iterating much quicker. I also start, what tends to happen in sport, and I've seen this repeatedly at different levels of sport, is when a sport is new, and let's be honest, triathlon's 20-something years old in terms of Olympics and, you know, really the popularity of long-distance triathlon really kicking off. When a sport is new, talent usually wins, because no one's really doing a great job of training. Then there's a period of professionalization where those who train better start to win. And then once that all evens out, then it becomes talent again, whatever talent is, whatever we want to call that, but the best genetics or whatever, right? Those aspects generally create the outliers early, and then it becomes the field gets leveled and those who train better might be succeeding more. And then everyone's training about at the limits, and then it becomes a talent thing again. And that's much more evident in more physiologically based sports, things like endurance sports versus team sports, where the tactical, technical aspects are slightly more impactful.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I want to come back to something just to clarify for the listeners that this paper is not a summary of like just the science itself. We're talking about scientists, but the scientists here are all applied scientists working
Yep.
directly with coaches of various federations and elite coaches, elite athletes. So it's more looking at what is happening in the real world and then writing a scientific paper about it. It's not about summarizing studies, intervention studies, or anything like that has been done.
Yeah, this is trying to codify and, I guess, science wash, so to speak, the art of what's happening at the coalface for some of these athletes, I guess.
Yeah, and they point to some potential future trends that they see might coming up. So do you want to run us through those?
Yeah, I mean, they talk about more extensive and advanced technological monitoring, and I think we're probably there for a lot of athletes already, with the exception of a few who are intentionally bucking that trend a little bit. I think where we're probably going to see is the influence of AI overlaying on top of that, which scares some coaches, but I actually think it'll just free them up, to be honest, and the art of coaching and the soft science of coaching will be better there. The heat and altitude stuff, I think we will see. So they mentioned that more precise use of heat and altitude, and I think, again, thinking about where we're at, which is quantifying everything, repeated measures, quantifying, whether you want to call that biohacking or whatever else, I think we'll start to do more of that, and people will start to appreciate their response more and individualization and adaptation timelines. And that'll come through a mixture of improved tracking, big data, but also probably some consumerization of this. You know, it's something like, you know, there are already consumer-based blood tests you can get, right? I think these will become more widely spread and cheaper, and that scale will help people to start to understand the science says this about heat, or the science says this about altitude at a population level, but for me as an individual, what does that actually mean? And how do I apply that to me? So I think we'll start to get there. Then they also talk about better understanding of athlete equipment interactions. And, you know, the easiest one here to explain is aero position for cyclists, right? We'll just get better and better at understanding that aspect. And maybe the other one is carbon shoes. And I know you've had some researchers on here, and I love the episodes talking about how do we choose a carbon shoe, right? Or how do we do that? And you can use a power meter to do that now. You don't even need to be in a lab to some degree. So I think we'll start to get to that, which is not just what does a shoe do on a population level, or what does it do to, what do these type of shoes do, but what does this specific shoe do to me as an individual? And I think that's where it's really important, especially with something like shoes, because there can be some non-responders, but there can also be negative responders. And so I think that, you know, that's quite big. And then a greater emphasis on preventing illness and injuries. I think, I don't know if we can do more of that. I think we'll just probably get better at it. And maybe some people could do more of it, but I think if you're not doing this, then I think you're mad. The best correlates I've seen across all sport to success is injury-free time. Time free of injuries is the best correlate to success in a medium to long-term time frame. So you should be doing everything you can to avoid injury and illness is my take on this. And it's why I'm so risk-averse in my own training. If you look at my training, you'd be quite surprised at how conservative it is, given how much of a technophile I am. I'm pretty conservative with coaching and training, and I'm so risk averse with the stuff. And maybe it's the lens of the medical practitioner who's seen these injuries, but I just think success can be quite hard to quantify, particularly on a sort of short-term timeline, but failure is really easy. And in my mind, that's injury. So that's kind of how I view the situation.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. I think maybe it comes back to what you said as well with everybody's aware of that, how important that is, but maybe we'll get better at just figuring out individually, okay, just like with altitude or with heat, what is my limit? What is my tolerance? And that's maybe where we can still make advancements, and potentially even technology and AI can help with that. So that would be interesting to see, but let's see how it plays out. But I do agree that, yeah, you're mad if you're not putting that as a primary focus, because that's from day one of this podcast, all of the coaches that have been on here have been talking about, yeah, staying injury free, staying illness free as much as you can, and how that's like such a great, the most fundamental pillar of building success.
Yeah, and we might see something like the integration of gait data, kinematics and kinetic data from, say, power meters to look at risk of musculoskeletal injury, right? We're using big data models for certain things, and that's foreseeable, and I'm sure there's a company doing it. I don't think I came up with that idea. So yeah, like that sort of stuff we'll see, and maybe it'll help, and you'll have to read through the signal and that noise at some point, but I think we'll get to see some really interesting stuff. And then it's about, you know, similar to the acute to chronic workload ratio stuff, is what does that actually mean for you, and how do you action that advice, right? And I think we've all probably seen something on social media recently of, you know, the physio talking to the runner, and the physio's like, listen, you can't do any running, and the runner like runs out the clinic to go do the interval session or whatever. So I mean, you have to act on the advice as well. So yeah, there's that. And the one other thing that I think I wanted to touch on from the paper is they mention updating sports science programs. And as somebody who's taught in, you know, sports science programs at 3 or 4 universities, I think this is needed. I think increasingly at universities in general, but definitely in sports science, theory is not as helpful as it used to be, and knowledge isn't as valuable as it used to be. You know, your phone has more knowledge in it than you could ever have, and your phone is more powerful than some of the computers we had in World War II. So I don't think the learning of facts is as helpful as it used to be, but I think the application of those facts and reasoning and sifting and sorting data becomes more and more important, and sifting and sorting through whatever becomes more important. So I'd love to see these sports science programs updated, and you know, my bias is then to include a lot more tech. So, you know, those sort of things I think makes a ton of sense. To be fair, the programs I taught in and was involved with had some really good tech that was involved. You know, we were using force plates in the early 2000s. So there was some cool stuff that I got to see and do there. So that stuff is now consumer grade, right? There are companies who have force decks out there, and that's really cool to see come from a university setting all the way back in.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So let's move on to the next question, which is, I mean, maybe you can tell the listeners, you have spent time with some of the best triathletes in the world, and you have talked with a lot of them through your podcast and so on. But so you're not a triathlete yourself, but you follow triathlon very keenly, and you are very knowledgeable about endurance sports in general and about triathlon. So when you look into triathlon and you look at what people are doing, which you do know, and you do look at that, what are the things that you would maybe change in how a lot of athletes approach something that we might call typical triathlon training.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate the compliments. Triathlon fan, for sure. Eagerly watched World Championships, both of them, and had some views there that I shared with you. Not so much about the athletes as much as the coverage, but that's for a different day. Look, I've also been friends with triathletes, you know, going through university. You know, podiatry programs fundamentally full of people who run, and some of them are runners and some of them are triathletes. And, you know, most of them when I was going through were triathletes. So I think probably the biggest observation I've always had, and look, I trained for a triathlon once and never did it. So I have the smallest, tiniest little bit of insight, but my lens is through a strength and conditioning lens. And that lens is, what are the goals? What's the end point that we need to get to? And how do we reverse engineer from there? A lot of endurance coaches go, where are we? And let's apply my program and then see where we get to. And I'm sort of the opposite way, which is, where do we need to get to? And let's apply a program that gets us there. And I think this is changing. Let's be clear. I don't want to paint everyone with one brush and I don't want to paint them all with that, but that's kind of the backdrop and context. But one of the things that I also use is like a weak point analysis or a SWOT analysis really clearly. And one of the things that everybody tells me about all levels of triathlon is that running off the bike is one of the hardest things you ever do, is you feel terrible. It feels strange. It's really hard to get going and those sort of things. And I always found it strange then, particularly in the context of Olympic distance, that people spent so much time on the bike when it was only 40 kilometers and they didn't do a lot of running off the bike. And it always just astounded me that if you're telling me that the hardest bit is running off the bike and only 40 kilometers of it is cycling, why are you doing any sessions where you're not running at least a kilometer after you ride? Like, do less riding, run a kilometer off the bike and do that. And of course, look, logistics and life and all those things. But it always struck me as strange, the volume of biking that Olympic distance athletes did, which makes more sense for long distance triathlon, of course. But then the lack of bike run brick sessions particularly. And that, I think that probably holds some truth in long distance triathlon as well, as the lack of brick sessions there that still surprises me given how hard people can find running off the bike.
So when we're planning this episode and we talked about this question, you said that you would be happy for me to counter some of your points.
Please,
so this
please.
One, yeah. This one I do have. Yeah, I do think that what you see is typical. I do think it makes sense actually. So I'm kind of, I would counter that point a bit, like to some extent. I actually think that most people don't find it that hard running off the bike. It does get hard later on, but that's more of a pacing issue, sometimes a nutrition or hydration issue. But I don't feel like it's that common, other than in maybe beginners that are doing their first triathlons, that you get off the bike and you just cannot run if you have paced the bike well. So my philosophy there is that, yeah, you do need to do a couple of runs off the bike in the lead up to a race, but and it is as much to assess your pacing and your nutrition and hydration as it is to train just the, let's say, the biomechanical or the physical aspects of running off the bike. But the reason that I think that a lot of people don't do a lot of brick runs is just because of injury prevention. And this is something that I had a discussion with another coach recently, and he mentioned having taken on several athletes recently from a particular school of thought of coaching, where actually running off the bike is a very integral part of that coaching philosophy, and how stress fractures of various kinds, I think he mentioned, I may be wrong about this, but I think he mentioned hip stress fractures is very common.
Interesting.
In that population. So just the fact of running off the bike, maybe running with a slightly altered form too much. But I think as important is probably the fact that when you're running off the bike, then you're often running in a glycogen depleted state. And we have seen recently quite a bit of research about the impact of that on markers of bone health. So I think that's the injury prevention is the big reason that people don't do it. The second one that is cited is that, well, you can, if you run off the bike, then you can't do as good of a qualitative session. Like, yeah, okay, running 1 kilometer to get to feel for the run, I think that's really nothing. So it doesn't really, it's not a session, and it maybe doesn't take away from doing a proper session later when you're fresh on the run. But I think when we're comparing what some people might do, which is, let's say, 7 or 8 times 1 kilometer off the bike at a hard race pace, then the argument is that, well, you would get more bang for buck by doing that as a standalone session. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's more of a strengths weakness analysis, as you say. Like, if you're somebody for whom it is a struggle, as you not in the later stages, but in the earlier stages of running off the bike, then yeah, you do need to practice that. But maybe what you find is that practicing it leads you to figure out what is actually going on. Maybe it's a bike fit issue as well. It could be a bike fit issue, and you figure out that, oh, that's where the problem is, because you could try to do it off of different types of bikes, do it off the road bike, do it off the triathlon bike. So yeah, those are some thoughts that I have about it.
Yeah, I mean, we saw Christian Blumenfeld, right, change bike positions and then with cramping in his PTO stuff. So like that's a real problem, as you said. And I think that's a really good answer. And again, in a hierarchy of decision-making, if I've told you that the top of my, like the bottom or the most important part of my decision-making pyramid is injury-free, then yeah, if it's a problem, don't run off the bike, 100%. And look, I'm absolutely not advocating or wouldn't think that you should be doing long, exhaustive bike sessions followed by long, exhaustive runs. It's more about like, hey, if those first 300-400 meters make you feel horrible and it's a real struggle point for you, then think about doing 300-400 meters every now and again off the bike more frequently, so that specific skill or that aspect of it is improved, or at least you're comfortable with it, you feel okay about it, and you're kind of like, yeah, this is where we are.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, to be honest, but that's the kind of training that that hasn't been done. I think traditionally people don't run that short off the bike. I mean, rarely. Like it's usually at the minimum, let's say 10 minutes, which isn't necessarily that much longer, but it's still a bit longer. And if you do 10 minutes, it would often be 10 minutes at race pace or 9 minutes at race pace and 1 minute warm down. So it's still a lot more significant than just 300 meters to try to get into your flow, or even 1 kilometer. So I think that it's definitely a good point, and especially if you are struggling with that, then that makes sense.
Well, it just comes down to my thoughts that like people look at endurance sports like they're a physiology problem, and to some degree they are, but a lot of it is actually you could use a different lens, which is skill. So if you look at triathlon as a skill, the skill is a mixture of things. It includes aspects or from a skill lens, you would say things like transitions, right? And everyone talks, okay, transitions are the third leg, and now we've got the fourth leg, which is nutrition, of course. But you would talk about other things like running off the bike, you know, the transitions, like what does that transition look like in different races for you? Do you need to be able to run barefoot on concrete for a period of time? Do you need to be able to run on sand for a period of time? All these little things that we sort of probably don't think too much of and may not make a big difference, right? They really probably don't to your average age grouper. But if you're towards a pointy end or you're worried about cutoff times or something like that, there might be some stuff you really need to think about there, or they could be the genesis of a problem later on. You know, if you're having to run an extended period of time, like I was watching Conan, they've got quite a long run in transitions, particularly from T1 to T2. And it's like, well, if you're not ready for that, that could cause you problems at the back end of your run, perhaps, if you've had to run a bunch of time barefoot somewhere. So I just think using a bit of a lens of that, you know, how are you going to take nutrition on the bike? How are you going to switch nutrition on the bike? How are you going to pick up nutrition? Like I saw Taylor Nibb with a bottle in her mouth, like things like this, where it's like a real skill aspect of it is how am I going to execute properly? I think if you use that lens, it might change some of the way you do things. Because then ultimately what it boils down to is I don't need to be able to run a marathon. I need to be able to run a marathon off the bike after a swim. And then it becomes about, you know, am I over biking and all those questions that you really do have from a physiological standpoint. But if you use a skill lens, it changes how the problem looks, I guess.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And I think that like this is something that especially for age groupers, like transitions, I think they do make a massive difference, in the sense that even if you're not like quite at the pointy end, wherever you are in the field, we train very hard. And if when we have a few years of triathlon training in our bodies already, then improvements are hard to come by. So gaining 5 minutes off of your, let's say, half Ironman time takes quite a lot of training, or good training to do that, and good execution. But then you do see a lot of people just give that up without even thinking about it in transitions, and sometimes even a lot more than 5 minutes. Like there are definitely cases of people take 5 minutes in each transition or 6 minutes in each transition when it could be done in 2.5-3 minutes. Ironman transitions are generally quite long for age groupers because there's so many people there, so they're not the 30 second transitions that we might see at the world triathlon level, but still in a lot of races you could get them done in under 3 minutes, and you see people taking 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes in just one transition. So that's I completely agree with the skill aspect, same thing with the bike, how are you carrying your nutrition, have you practiced having the bottle behind your saddle so you can get it out and get it back there? Do you lose time actually doing that? Would it make more sense to have a camelback in your tri suit and be able to just drink continuously? There are good 2-liter camelbacks that I can recommend, and that takes you a long way. There's just a lot of skill elements that I completely agree. We don't think about them as much as we should. We think about it. The trend is to think about triathlon as a physiology problem.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, there's a lot of skills going into it as well.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that people might do is what nutrition is going to be on course and can I take that? And that's a really smart way to do it. The other way might be, how do I make myself so resilient that I don't have a problem with any nutrition? And I'm pretty confident in all of that stuff. And some people will never get there, but how can you create that for yourself and create like an anti-fragility in that aspect or a robustness there? I'm thinking to some of my experiences in trail running and some decision-making I made wrong, right? So not stopping to fill an extra water bottle and then getting caught out because I don't have enough water, or not taking an extra bit of fuel and then making a mistake there and bonking a little bit, right? And this has happened to me in trail races, and I'm not talking decades ago, I'm talking about months ago. So decision-making is part of it as well, is how do you make these decisions and in what context? Do you have rules for yourself? Do you just fill up every time? You know, what's the story there? And looking at that correlation into the elite area, UTMB, which is now owned by Ironman, so it's okay to talk about it on a triathlon podcast. The transition times historically, or not transition, but aid station time used to be long. People used to take minutes and whatever. And I'd still encourage age groupers in transition, if you have to take an extra minute to make sure that you're more comfortable, not going to get a blister or something like that, then probably do that because you are going to save time. But understanding where that line sits and that balance is really important. But to go back to, so people used to take minutes in these aid stations. The most crucial aid station where people sort of drop out the most and have the most problems and spend the longest time in UTMB, the leaders went through there in less than 3 minutes this year. And that used to be as long as like 10, 15 minutes for some of them. So you can really see, and Jim Walmsley, who won it, talked about he practiced transitions with his wife who crewed him. They practiced where he held everything. They practiced doing that. He would come in, they would change everything out, and then he would go again. Like that sort of stuff is the difference for some people, right? And it wasn't the difference for him. He won by quite a margin, but you know, it's real for some people. There is sometimes marginal gains are not so marginal. So you need to understand that. And then the counter swing to that is always make sure that you're comfortable, as I said. So understanding that and how to make those decisions is really important as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's useful to think about it as well in terms of how much do you have to gain, and what do you have to invest, whether it's time or money, to gain that, and then what are the other options you have where you can gain time? So think about transitions. Maybe you only need to do a couple of transition sessions or transition practices, which you can do after your bike ride or before it on a Saturday, the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to your race. And you could just save a minute and a half in each transition just with some simple. It might not be like, you might not get to the point where you're doing the best transition that you could possibly do in your entire life if you just focused on it for a lot longer, which elite athletes obviously do. But you might get a lot of time there just by the fact that it's something you haven't practiced. So it's more beginner improvements that you're looking at there. But if you're looking at, well, how am I going to take 3 minutes off my run time, and that might be just increasing your running volume, which might then have some downsides of increased injury risk or you don't, just not having the time to do that. So it's exactly. It's about weighing the investment with the potential gain.
How about if I took an hour off my bike time and spread that across a week to do 2 half-hour transition schedules, right? Or 2 half-hour transition sessions. So if you think about that from a time allocation standpoint, an hour of easy riding in a big training week, let's say you're training 15 hours plus, like it's probably not a great deal to take away from the bike. It's probably not going to be noticeable on race day, but the transition time might be. So, yeah,
absolutely. And it's really cool to hear about UTMB. I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know that at all. So it sounds like triathlon training almost when he's doing these transitions.
Of course. And look, they get really important from different aspects. Is where do you keep things? How do you throw out garbage? All that sort of stuff. There's lots of little things. And I've been part of crewing at UTMB, and it's stressful. It's where are we setting up? How are we setting up? How are we going to get the athlete through? What are we changing? How do we make sure they've had enough calories? How do we calculate that? How do we force them to eat a bit? What do they want in this transition? What do we need to have out? Like, it's stressful because part of the challenge with UTMB is, or something like UTMB is, flavor fatigue is so real for trail runners. They're out there for so long. You know, we think that Ironman's long. It's 17 hours or less. UTMB is like 20 hours or more. So you get so much flavor fatigue, so many different things, and people need so many different, you know, there's times of day, there's climatic issues. So do they want something warm or cold? Are they going to be hot or cold? Do we, you know, in this tactical aspects of changing headlights, do we give them the heavy headlights or the light ones? Because they have to have a headlight at all times, but they don't need to run with a heavy one if they're not going to use it. There's all this stuff. I mean, the optimization is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. That is cool, but it's also very intense.
Oh, yes.
Anything else that comes to mind? Any other interesting observations you have about triathlon training performance?
I mean, swimming is interesting. You've had episodes on this, and I gave myself a concussion from nodding so hard at the time talking about swim training. And I just find it really interesting how we break swim training up. Everything gets broken up into almost sprint intervals of hundreds of meters or five, you know, something like that. And I don't think people are doing that much swimming that's long. So call it 400 meters plus intervals. And I don't think people are swimming open water, even though they have access to it at some points. And I think those two things, again, compare that to, say, cycling or run training, where they're doing these longer blocks of work. They're just not doing that in the pool and that, or in the open water. And both of those things are really important. And I mean, historically, Australians have swum really well because they spend their lives, you know, at the beach swimming and learning surf conditions and waves and that sort of stuff. And I think if we saw more true sort of sea swimming, I think that the difference we would see would be even more. It'd be really interesting to see that and the implications of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I definitely agree with that. But you already see to some extent that some among athletes with a swimming background, the ones that have done a bit more open water swimming, which isn't generally the way that the open water swim circuit goes. As far as I'm aware, I'm not following it very closely, but most of that is not like big swell necessarily. It's pretty gentle conditions, yep. Almost like in reservoirs or things like that.
Yeah, so definitely.
So it is a bit like pool swimming, but you still see that the athletes that have more open water swimming experience rather than just pool swimming experience, even though they might be the same speed in the pool, you see the advantage that the open water swimmers like Lucy Charles Barkley has. So I definitely agree with that. And I think that for age groupers, it's a lot, the difference is a lot bigger basically than it might be for professional athletes, because they spend so much time in the pool anyway that they're going to get fairly close to their like swim potential in the open water. And we're talking a bit more marginal gains, which still make a big difference for them. It makes a more bigger difference, the marginal gains there. But yeah, for age groupers, I definitely think that if you can do more open water swimming, then absolutely 100% do that. But regardless, if you're training for a longer swim, then make sure that you swim longer intervals as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
And then moving on a bit, so to follow up on what we talked about a little bit already with the almost opposition of health and performance, what would you say then to athletes listening to this that are performance oriented but equally they don't want to compromise their health? What are the things to keep in mind and consider?
Yeah, I think in this case, I tend to talk to people about the spectrum. So where do you sit on that spectrum, right? So if we say that the elite athletes sit on the complete performance spectrum, which is if making any decisions that are in opposition, right? Because some things are aligned. So sleep is aligned. We agree that sleep will improve performance and health. So that's not a decision-making point. But there are some decision-making points, right? And so if you get there, you need to understand where you sit on that. Are you 50-50? Is it that you roughly want to perform 50%, but you roughly want to be healthy 50%? Or are you 60-40? How are you making, you know, just get a rough idea of where you sit on that spectrum versus, say, the professional athlete where it doesn't matter. I just have to perform, right? I'm going to sacrifice health. And you see this, you know, they often say, you know, if you could dope and not get caught and you knew it was going to shorten your life, right? There's that famous survey. Would you do it? And most of them say yes. Right. So that speaks to how much they want to perform. Right. So understand where you are on that spectrum and then use that to as a lens to make your decisions through. So for me is a good example. You know, I know that, you know, I've run an okay marathon. I know that to get better, I need to do one of a handful of things. The first thing is probably train more. And the second is to probably cut some volume from my upper body in terms of the gym training I do. And I'm not willing to do that from a health standpoint because I think it's really important for bone health and long-term health and those sort of things. So I'm not going to cut that upper body volume. So I'm still quite heavy and big physically for a runner or an endurance athlete in general. I'd probably be big and heavy for a triathlete as well. So that's one of the ways I made that decision is just health is a priority for me. Let's call it 60-40, maybe even 70-30. And in that using that lens, I then made the decision to keep the upper body gym volume rather than let's cut that volume, let's go away from that and go, you know, another way, add a bunch more running volume and be done there and start to drop muscle mass and therefore use that as maybe a one strategy to get quicker, I guess.
I think that's a great example with the strength training that does come up with age group athletes, let's say, especially the time crunched ones. Let's say you might have 7, 8, 9 hours to train per week. Are you then going to spend an hour and a half of that doing strength training? If your focus is just being the absolute best athlete you can be, then probably I would say no. But when I coach athletes in this situation, I tend to say that the strength training will be beneficial from a health perspective. And especially if we're talking about athletes of a slightly older age, then the more important it becomes, basically. So then I think for a lot of athletes, it ends up being a yes, even though it might be a bit of a compromise with triathlon performance.
No, I think that makes a ton of sense. I think, just really being clear on where you lie on that spectrum. And so that's going to affect things like, and life will impact it as well, right? So it's not just going to be health and performance. It's also going to be logistics for some people. So is your priority work? Is it family? Is it all those things? Because there are going to have to be trade-offs. And then just understanding and being really clear on where your priorities lie and therefore how you make decisions based on that. So it's going to impact things like diet. It's going to impact all these other things. Some people talk to me, hey, I don't want to have too many gels because I think it's bad for my teeth. And I think it's a really good discussion to have. But if you want to perform at optimal, you need to have those gels because you need to get used to them for race day and you need to be fueling that training in that way. And, you can't probably be eating something more natural like a banana during a run or something like that. So, there's lots of ways to make these decisions. And I mean, to some degree, prolonged mouth breathing through endurance training might be bad for oral health as well, right? So you may say that you shouldn't be doing a ton of prolonged stuff with an open mouth, and that might be very reasonable. So you need to be informed, clear on where you lie, and then happy with the decisions you make through the lens you make them.
Yeah, no, that is a very interesting point. Is there any other thing nutrition-wise that you think are things that people should be aware of other than the dental health potential consequences with having lots of gels and sports products?
I mean, there's lots of questions at the moment around the health of athletes long-term, right? And I don't really pick sides in this. I find it all interesting around carbohydrate dosing and risk of metabolic health issues as I go forward. And there's an interesting study done recently. Andrew Kutnick was the lead author, and Tim Noakes is one of the other authors as well, on the paper looking at CGMs in athletes and risk of diabetes in endurance athletes and switching them over to a higher fat diet and actually move the crossover point for carbohydrate and fat as well, which is really interesting. Probably the most interesting part of that paper is I think it was about 85% of VO2 max for the crossover point, which is quite significant given our understanding previously. But something like that might be worth considering is if you do compromise yourself to some degree by high carbohydrate intake during training, is that something you're okay with, right? And would you prefer to switch to something else, going to a lower carbohydrate approach? And again, that might concede some performance, and that's okay if that's the decision you make it through, right? And again, I'm not going to pick sides in that discussion or debate. I'm not going to say any of that's true or false. I'm just saying an if situation, right? Which is, if this is going to be the case, which could be the case, then how do we make that decision? Are you making an informed decision, or are you just going in blind and assuming that, a ton of gels are healthy and we should be eating, a bowl of gels for breakfast? But yeah, that's kind of probably the only other thing I'd think about there.
Yeah. What about, I'm not sure how familiar you are with that, but heart health in endurance athletes has been a bit of a topic.
Yeah.
What is your understanding of that?
I actually saw a conference presentation on this recently, and is something that I'm considering in my own context, if I'm honest, for a number of reasons. I mean, Tim O'Donnell is one that comes to mind, right? Who he had a heart attack and then is now back racing. I think my read on this has been the same for a long time. And having spoken to one of the cardiologists for Team Netherlands or Team NL recently about this, it basically nets out to the same thing with atrial fibrillation, which is a heart rhythm issue, as it does with heart disease, which is the pointy end or excessive. And I think probably excessive is hard to quantify, but I would say probably over 10 hours a week with any intensity in it of pure endurance training is probably like roughly a helpful rule of thumb to use. Beyond that, it starts to become perhaps detrimental, but not at the same rate as it was beneficial to start with. That's to say that you do start to see a reversing of that. If we start to see an improvement in health, you start to see a nadir and then a perhaps decrement. But it's really about that's, you're still going to be in a better position there. And one of the challenges, and I really like this from the cardiologist that he said, was if I take away your marathoning, for instance, when he was talking to me, are you still going to do a similar amount of training, but with less intensity or something like that? And I was like, oh, probably not. He's like, yeah, so we don't want to take that away, because the binary option is effectively you're training to a stage that we think is a little bit detrimental versus not training anywhere near enough to maximize out your health benefit. So we'd be better off that way. And I think that's probably where most people I speak to sort of end up at, or they net out at, is, yeah, it's going to be an increased risk, but you're still going to be much better off. And I think we're going to start to understand things a little bit better in the next 5 to 10 years, given the talk I heard from this guy recently. And yeah, I think we'll understand things a bit better. I think we're probably going to get a bit better at treating as well, and intervening and understanding risk and tracking risk and what to do with athletes as well. But I do think it's something you should really consider in the context of things, especially because a lot of people get into triathlon probably to be healthy, right? They probably were a little bit unhealthy getting into triathlon to be healthy, and then quickly get bitten by the bug, and then quickly end up, you know, on the hedonic treadmill where they're, you know, now it's, I want to do an Ironman, now I want to get to Kona, now I want to perform at Kona, now I want to run this time at Kona. And, you know, it gets more and more and more and more on the hedonic treadmill. And, you know, you're never really that happy, is the other thing. Like, whenever you perform, you're happy enough for a while, but you're never really, like, there's always another carrot, right? It's the carrot attached to the stick in front of you, which is like, I can never quite get it. So I think that context is helpful for people to understand as well.
Yeah, that is all too true. But just to clarify one thing there. So after 10 hours, if we take that, understanding that it's not an exact marker, but after that, you start to see detriment, but it's not, you're not talking about a detriment compared to not doing any training, but it's starting to get a little bit less beneficial than it was when you were at that optimum. So you're going towards maximum benefit, and then you're going back trending at some point towards zero, but that might be at, we don't know exactly what point, but even if you're training 15 hours, you're still getting a positive effect. You're just getting less of a positive effect than you would have at 10 hours. Is that the correct understanding?
Yeah. So, I mean, the 10 hours is something I plucked out of the air. So don't quote me on the 10 hours, but let's use 10 hours as a rough line in the sand. I think to double click for you and to sort of clarify a little bit better. So thank you for the question is, the rate of improvement in health overall is significant to a point. It then starts to probably plateau a little bit and then starts to decrease a little bit. But the rate of decrease after that plateau is much less than the increase prior to it. So you're still going to end up, you know, using the 10-hour thing. Yeah, okay, so at 10 hours, we're starting to plateau. At 15, you're not going to be at the same level as you were at 5 hours. It's probably going to be at something more like 9 hours, eight, you know, maybe 9 hours 30, you're starting to really decrease, but it's not at the same rate. And that's probably because we're looking at all cause mortality, and that is getting death from anything, which includes getting hit by a car and all those things, right? It's everything. And that decreases. And then it starts to increase a little bit because the risk of specifically cardiac problems, so heart problems, starts to increase a little bit. And then maybe other things as well because of excessive training for whatever reason, right? Like your chance of getting hit by a car is probably a little bit more if you're cycling for 30 hours a week than if you're cycling for 20 hours a week, because it's an area under the curve problem. You're just exposing yourself to more risk.
That makes sense. So you said you call yourself technophile. Let's discuss that a little bit more. Let's start with, what technology do you use yourself in your training?
Well, in training, it's a little bit minimal.
What is your technology set that you use?
Yeah.
Let's say.
This gets crazy pretty quickly, I think. And look, one thing I would say is I'm actually pretty conservative in general. And a lot of the stuff I'm doing is because I actually enjoy it. So it's a bit of a hobby for me, and it's the industry I'm in. So I kind of need to know as well. So I will use that as my first caveats. But yeah, look, I use a GPS watch, of course, but then my GPS watch is probably older than most. I've had mine for, I think, 4+ years now and haven't updated it. So
not old.
It's not at all, but I know people who are updating every year, right? Yeah, so really. let's put it this way. There are two models after mine that I currently have. So that's enough to suggest that. And it's no longer supported. They're not updating it anymore. So like, let's use that as context there. I use a heart rate monitor. We had a discussion the other day offline. I'm in the optical heart rate monitor field. I'm sick of chest straps. I haven't had great experiences personally with them. But I do think if you're using optical, it has to be an external sensor. It can't be your watch. I think if you're using watch, yeah, give up. I obviously work for Super Sapiens, so I use a CGM. I have an Oura Ring that I use mostly because I thought, you know, my understanding at the time was that HRV overnight was the same as in the mornings. It definitely isn't. And they don't track the same for everybody. So I now track, well, I also track on the side. I use HRV for training to track my morning heart rate variability. And then I use Rewire Fitness to track some neural markers of fatigue. I then have an 8 Sleep because that's mostly for sleep quality. And my wife sleeps. She wants hot. I want cold. It's good for that. And then I use a velocity-based training sensor as well for my gym stuff. And that's really because I enjoy it and it's really interesting and fun. It's not a performance thing. I don't program based on that at the moment, but I, you know, at one point I probably will. So that's the most part of my stack, I'd say, at the moment. I've used bits and pieces. I've used hydration sensors as well. I've played with some DFA Alpha 1 stuff for HRV, looking at intensity. I've done a bunch of other things. I use the Rewire buttons as well for some neurofitness training and mental fatigue stuff. So I'll play with pretty much anything. And then the stuff that lasts is stuff I either really enjoy or am seeing benefit from and making decisions based off.
Yeah. What about lactate, the hot topic the last couple of years?
I mean, I went through a sports science degree, so I did in the early 2000s, I was taking lactates and doing a bunch of them. I don't do a lot myself with lactate. I probably will at one point, but it's probably not going to change a lot of what I do. I think my training is climatically very consistent, and that is I don't travel a lot. I'm not in different locations. So as a result, I can get really dialed in on intensity based on heart rate and RPE. And I think that's, you know, talking to some of the world's best triathletes and best athletes in general, the whole goal of training with data is to not then have to use it on race day and to dial in your feeling. And the more and more I read about this stuff, the more and more I realize that the complex integration of everything is done by the brain. And if you can dial that in, then that's really important. You know, when I was a teenager, before GPS watches were a thing, I used to run with a guy who could tell you how far you'd run and what pace you were running at. And he was like a clock. I kid you not. He would be able to tell you we'd be running track reps and he would be saying we're running at, you know, 65 pace and we would be. I could never do that. And I still to this day can't really do that. I can kind of do it maybe on a road with some paces I'm pretty used to. I can definitely do it roughly in zone stuff. So zone 1, 2, 3 using a 3-zone model, I can pretty much do that. I mean, zone 3 is not real hard, but you know, I can kind of, I've got a pretty good handle on that and using heart rate to triangulate that stuff. So that's probably, yeah, that's probably why I haven't used a lot of lactate, but it is something I'm really interested in. Obviously, continuous lactate monitors are coming. I'm really interested in seeing that data. I've got a feeling that it's going to confuse people a lot more before it gets to anything else. I think people are going to get a continuous lactate monitor and think, yeah, this is going to be just like my lactate curve. It's just going to be just like capillary lactate from a finger or an earlobe. And it's just not. It's measured in a different fluid, a different part of the body with different metabolism. So there's going to be an onboarding curve for the industry as well as the end user that'll be pretty steep, I think.
So let's use that as an example, because I was going to ask what would a good approach be for anybody trying to approach any new piece of technology? If we use continuous lactate monitoring as an example, whenever it comes to market, how would you approach it when you start using it and trying to figure it out and learn how to actually benefit from it?
So I'd put it into context. So what is lactate, right? Why do we measure it at all? So that's probably the first thing, is to understand what you're actually measuring and why. Because if you're just measuring it for fun, that's fine. Go for it and enjoy it, right? And I do this for some of it. But understand what you're trying to get from it. What informationally are you trying to get from it? And where does that sit in your understanding and your system of how you prescribe or modify training or all those things, right? Because it's not going to sit in the same spot for everybody. So we talked about the Norwegian method. You know, famously, they use lactate perhaps for intensity control. Other people will use it for other reasons, right? It might be to test how tough a session is, to understand marathon pace, whatever it is. So understand where it sits and what you're trying to gain from it. Then you probably need to do a period of time where you do nothing with the data and just observe it to try and understand it in the context of what you understand already. So in my case, that would be, if you think this is zone one, right, in a 3-zone model, go out and test and see what that lactate looks like. How does that lactate look over a period of time, be it half an hour, 2 hours at that intensity, right? What are the lactate kinematics doing? And then do the same for zone two, do the same for zone three, and do that over and over again, and then do some traditional ramp tests and do all that stuff. So you just got to collect a bunch of data so you understand the scenarios, so that you understand what you're seeing in the context of what you already understand. So if we think about a traditional understanding of a lactate curve, it's classically the, you know, the parabola. It starts to go up, you know, zone two is here, you know, in a 5-zone model, or, you know, the top of zone one in a 3-zone model sits here. LT1, whatever you want to call it. LT2 sits here. This is maximum lactate steady state. What does that all look like with a continuous lactate monitor, not earlobe or finger lactate? Or you collect them both and understand them in the context of each other. But I would say that that's pretty fraught with challenge, because they're going to be so different that the kinematics of the two will be very different. Because in one of the settings, you're seeing the outcome at earlobe or finger of whole body metabolism of lactate, whatever that looks like, the production, the metabolism, the use, you know, and then whatever's left. Whereas the other one will be in a different spot. And so the blood flow will be different and the resulting lactate will be different. I guarantee you, if you put a continuous lactate monitor on a quad and on a tricep and you're running, they would look different. Those things will be different. And what's important is then to understand what's important for you as the end user and how you would use that data. So if it's for intensity control, think about that. And if it's for, you know, something else, then think about it in that context.
Yeah, I think you touched on a few really important points there. First of all, not trying to act on the data before you really understand it. So that's a really good one. And then the flip side of that is that this is something that I do think is quite common as well, is that people get devices, gadgets, and they never get to the point of actually using it, which is, again, it can be fine if you're just using it because you like it and it's interesting to see. But that's sometimes where we can get into a false sense of technology actually helping, but are you actually using it? Are you taking action on it? So if you want the technology to be useful for you, then you need to first just learn how it works, understand it well, but then actually know what is the action that you want to take from the information that it provides. So it is definitely, again, it's an investment, not just in the sense that you buy the technology, but learning to understand it, investing the time in collecting data, in understanding the context of it all, and then it can start to be useful, hopefully.
Yeah, that's actually two of the things I didn't really mention was exactly that, which is there is going to be a cost, financial, but also opportunity cost. What are you going to not be doing when you're understanding that data or all those things? So, of course, maybe for some people it's leisure like me, so it's fun and fine. I'm happy to spend that time. But if it's time away from something that really matters, family or other data that is a signal, not noise for you, then you need to keep that in context. And maybe this is where the big data algorithms and AI approach sort of helps us. So we can just pile this all into a model and it can interpret it for us at one point. I'd also say, like, understand the limitations of what you're measuring. And so I gave the example before of risk-based heart rate for PPG sensors. If you understand what it's measuring, it makes complete sense why the wrist isn't a great place to measure that. It's measuring changes in light fundamentally. Your watch moves on your wrist moves around, the capillaries, arteries, etc., veins, blood flow to the skin, all changes in the wrist because of movement. So when you're measuring it at a different spot, be it bicep or fore, that's a lot more consistent. So it makes sense. So it's not that it's inaccurate at the wrist, it's that it's a bad spot to measure it. So I actually wouldn't be taking a continuous lactate monitor and comparing it to capillary lactate, because you're measuring two different things. You're grading an apple on its ability to be an orange. It just isn't that. Yes, they're both fruit, but apples aren't oranges. You're looking at something different. So we see this a lot with continuous glucose monitoring. People go, oh, it's not the same as my finger stick. It's like, yeah, it's not meant to be. Now, of course, for people with diabetes, the lens has always been understanding glucose through that lens, which is finger stick and diabetes. But in people without diabetes, it's completely different. And interstitial glucose, where it's measured in the back of the tricep, might actually be more helpful in some respects. It's just different. It's completely different kinematically, particularly during exercise. So understanding that context is really important. Doesn't mean it's good, bad, or indifferent. It's just, it just is different, I guess. It's not good or bad. It's just different data. And so that's kind of how I would think about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's another example is the muscle oxygen saturation measurements that, yep, that are relatively popular now, I guess. Like, not so much that like a lot of people have them, but they get talked about quite a fair bit. And even some people have talked about, yeah, they used to be all in on lactate, but now they're using muscle oxygen saturation. And I understand why, because it is in the same way a measure of internal stress in a way, but it measures something completely different in a completely different way. So when you're doing, let's say, a ramp test with a Moxie or another muscle oxygen saturation device, then you shouldn't expect to see something that looks like a lactate curve because it's measuring something completely different. So you have to kind of approach it from the perspective of, okay, I'm learning something completely new here, and not try to translate it into like lactate parlance, if continuing on with that example, but understanding it for what it is.
And also understand what's being measured and what's being interpreted from that. So yeah. Things like respiratory rate are a good example. Respiratory rate's often measured as a result of heart rate. And it's sinoatrial something. I can't remember the exact name there, my apologies. But basically, your heart beats slightly differently as a result of your breath. And so as a result, we can interpret what your respiration rate is from that. That's not quite the same as actual respiration rate. So there are these respiration shirts, which I think use stretch sensors instead. So now it's looking at expansion of the chest wall. Now that's different, right? But again, if you're doing strength training with them, maybe you need to consider the implications for noise in that, given that you're contracting muscles. So just understanding what you're doing, how things are being measured, and what's being interpreted from that is really, really important.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Do you have any additional advice on that topic, or should we move on to the next one?
I think probably the only other thing is understanding where you want to sit on the adoption curve, right? So there are early adopters. They're the first people to do it. You've got to be okay with products being pretty average in that space, particularly if it's a startup. They're just going to be bad, and that's the goal, and they need people to use them and to get better. Or do you want to be a late adopter? Right? And understanding what the implications of this are, right? And you're going to have to spend a lot more time if you're an early adopter than a late adopter. So just understanding where you want to be on that curve from a time as well as financial resources point of view. So I'm often quite late in some of this stuff, despite being a technophile. Some of it makes a lot of sense, stuff that I've been waiting for. And then some of it I'm quite late, stuff that I'm not so sure about. So Moxie is a great example. I haven't touched it yet, super keen now. But to this point, I've been very late onto it, right? Whereas other people have been using it for ages.
Yeah. Yeah, we can have a discussion on that off air. I don't have a Moxie, to be fair, but I have a muscle oxygen saturation device, and I haven't used it much, to be fair, because I just didn't find it particularly useful. I understand that some of that is just that I need to use it more, and I haven't invested my time into the actual logistics of measuring it and then getting the data into a convenient format and all of that. But that's just the challenge with a lot of these technologies, that it is so much more than just putting a device on your body, and then you get some new insights that you didn't have before. That's not what you should expect with anything, really. Even if it's something that measures things very accurately, getting to actual insights is completely different.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone wants that all-seeing, all-knowing dashboard, right? All my wearables get integrated so I can see all the data in one spot. But that, from a tech point of view, is really difficult to do, for lots of reasons that sit with different companies and all that sort of stuff. But for the most part, that's very difficult. That's why things like Training Peaks and Strava tend to have a bit of an aggregator function for people. But having that data together is the sort of panacea. And there are many companies building these dashboards, but they're just difficult and expensive to build, because every time anybody updates anything, they've got to spend a bunch of money to keep up to date. So unless you win that game and no one else is there, it's really hard.
Yeah, definitely. So moving on a little bit, we have talked about a few areas, including training and health and technology, that there is a lot of talk about and a lot of information about online and social media and everywhere. But there's also a lot of misinformation and sometimes even like pseudoscience. So how do you think, what is your advice for how people should navigate this landscape? It goes back a little bit to what you said about how you see that sports science degrees need to be updated. Like, it's not about finding information, it's about filtering information.
Yeah, I think probably the if I had to give a one word summary or one word answer here is carefully. So you navigate it carefully. I think, look, there's a lot of negativity towards marketing, and I'll be really clear, that's part of my role at Super Sapiens is marketing, right? And people can throw the stones they want to throw. But what I would say is I think everybody could be better at marketing and should learn more about marketing. That's from a coaching point of view, because marketing is fundamentally storytelling and getting buy-in from people. And I think from a coach's perspective, getting people to buy into your program, even if they're already paying you, is huge. And I've seen huge improvements in buy-in from athletes create huge successes in their performance with the same or a worse program. So I would say that for the most part, and then likewise for health, from a health perspective, if we could somehow market a healthy diet and physical activity, the world would be a better place, right? So let's be clear that marketing isn't all bad, and I think it gets a bit of a bad rap. But you make a good point, which is that things can be over-marketed or marketed in a questionable way. And I think that's you've got to be able to see through that. I think, again, you probably need to understand some of the stuff a little bit to a little bit of a deeper level. So you need a level of like literacy in the space, I think, that would help it. There's a concept from Thinking Fast and Slow. I'm not sure if you know the book by Daniel Kahneman. It's a heavy read, but great read. And I think they talk about thick slicing and thin slicing. I think if you can spend the time to thin slice it and really dig in and understand it, then it will be helpful. If not, and you want a thick slice and really use a rule of thumb, is probably ask somebody who does spend that time, right? This is why people like the DC Rainmaker have followings, because he spends time really evaluating the tech and its accuracy and those sort of things. So I think outsourcing to there, and we're in a pretty good spot, and you need to think about incentives in that context as well for why these people are doing what they're doing, and trying to find somebody that you really benefit there. The other thing, I mean, I don't know if you've heard of the Lindy effect, but it's something a mentor of mine brought up to me that I've sort of used as well. And I think it's pretty helpful in all things training, but definitely in tech. And basically the Lindy effect states that a theorized phenomenon by which the future life expectancy of some non-perishable things, like a technology or an idea, is proportional to its current age, which basically means something that's been around for a long time has probably survived for a reason, and it will probably also keep being around for a long period of time, versus something that's new, maybe you want to be a little bit more careful on it. So lactate's a great example. It's been around for decades, so it's probably not going anywhere. Now, of course, a continuous lactate monitor might be different, and that's worth a discussion, but lactate as a concept and using it isn't new. So it's probably more robust as something to use. Same with heart rate and those sort of things, versus the new thing, maybe let's call it muscle oxygenation, where in 10, 15 years, it may not be around because people go, well, actually, it's not better than lactate. Let's just do lactate. It's easier. Right. Yeah. So that's the kind of the Lindy effect. And maybe that's one of the things you want to use there. I remember when kettlebells became big in gyms at a certain point, my mentor said, yeah, it's not surprising. And they're going to stay around because they were around with the Soviets I don't even know when they started, but that's a good example of something that could have been a fad, but hasn't really been a fad as much as it stayed around because there is some value to it. So perhaps that's helpful. And then the other thing I was thinking about is using a couple of other lenses. So what if I'm wrong? So what are the consequences of being wrong in either direction? So what if I don't start using Moxie and it's helpful? Or what if I do start using it and it's not helpful, right? What are the consequences of being wrong in those ways? And what's the cost versus being wrong versus right? Right. So if I don't use Moxie, what's the cost of being wrong? Well, yeah, I haven't bought it yet, so I'm a bit behind with my training. And what's the cost of being wrong if it isn't useful? It's like, well, the cost of a Moxie monitor. Right? And I don't want to throw stones at Moxie. I'm absolutely not. It's just a helpful example we've been talking about in this podcast. But, you know, to use a similar way of thinking here, when I was sitting doing some game analysis for a rugby team I was coaching just before the pandemic hit, I was sitting in a cafe. I'll never forget the day. I remember exactly where I was sitting. A friend of mine was living in China at the time, working for the Chinese Olympic organization. And he texted me and said, mate, this stuff is real. Buy a bunch of, you know, hand sanitizer, masks, whatever, before it really gets to be a problem there, because it is going to be a problem there. And I remember sitting there thinking at the time, well, how do I make this decision? Because I wasn't so sure about it, and it didn't feel like it was going to be a big deal at the time. This is, you know, just before everything really kicked off and borders closed. And I was like, well, if I'm wrong here and I buy a bunch of stuff, I've spent, you know, 50, 60, 80 euros or whatever, and that's not a big consequence for me where I'm at the moment. Whereas if I'm wrong and this stuff is out of date and it's a real risk for my family and I, then it's a big consequence. So I made that purchase right then and there. I was like, easy. You know, sometimes these decision-making lenses can help people, I guess. And that's just, you know, another example of it.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. Then another topic that I want to get to you, and I feel like you have a lot of great insight on this as well, is about weight. So I see you smiling there. Yeah. It's a podcast, the listeners can't see you. But yeah, what are your thoughts around weight in endurance sports?
Yeah, I think it's touchy, right? And I think one of the problems we have is that it's hard to talk about, right? Weight is taboo. It's hard to talk about, especially, you know, I want to be sensitive. This is two guys speaking on a podcast, right? And of course, weight is obviously something that is sometimes perceived to be more pertinent to females, although not the case. We're starting to see increased awareness of relative energy deficiency in men as well. And I think it's a healthy conversation to have, because I think the more we can all have it, the better off everybody is. But I think, like, there's just this obsession with being lighter in endurance sport and power to weight ratios. And I'm not as convinced that it's that linear. I'm not saying it doesn't matter at all, but I think the view in endurance sport is like, this is completely linear. If I lose a kilogram, I'll be X amount faster. And I don't think it is. We're not perfect machines. it's not a linear thing. There are any number of systems that require this. Mood is one of them, right? If you're not as happy, but you're a little bit lighter, will you race better? Well, probably not. What about, you know, there's the endocrine system exists as well, and that exists to both try and help maintain a weight that you're at, but also exists in a more, you know, complex balance. And this is the system that gets disrupted with relative energy deficiency, for instance, the menstrual cycle, which is an endocrine function, and all those things as well. So I just think it's not as simple as let's get lighter. And I think a lot of people would be better off understanding the training constraints that they need and trying to optimize the ins, which is my training and my diet, and then let the out level out for itself.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And also going to say, yeah, I have mentioned before on the podcast about like hearing about world-class athletes, triathletes that basically started growing again in their early 20s after like stopping growing many, many years before, but then just due to a change in eating habits, in nutrition. So I think a lot of athletes are, I think we're just starting to hear about these, and because I heard another example literally this morning, I think, or was it yesterday, somebody who in their mid 20s grew 5 centimeters in a few months when they started like eating more, gaining some weight, but also gained a significant amount of height in their mid 20s. So I think that it's just something that I think that the thing is we as you say, we are obsessed a bit with getting lighter and then it's going to get better. And that sometimes leads us to take unhealthy decisions. It comes back to what we were talking about before about health in a way. But I think we don't really understand the performance side as well as we think we do with lighter being better, because as you say, it probably isn't. That's my coaching experience. I'm saying it as a hard statement almost, even though this is not something that like is I haven't seen like directly studied or anything, but my coaching experience is that it's very difficult to say that getting lighter would make you faster, and sometimes you see the exact opposite happen where putting on some weight can make you faster, and that goes across swimming, biking, and running potentially, or it can go across at least two of the sports, and the third one is neutral. So,
For me personally, I ran some of my fastest times when I was significantly lighter than where I am, and then some of my fastest times now, in similar distances. And you go, okay, well, you've advanced as an athlete. You're like, yeah, exactly right. And that's part of the problem here is a lot of people have this view of I was X weight when I ran well or ran this great time in a triathlon, or did this great time in a triathlon. But there's this famous statement is, you know, no man walks through the same river twice because he's changed and so has the river. And I think it's really important to remember that is your body adapts. That's what training's about. The whole goal is for your body to adapt. So it's a different thing every day. You know, those changes are very small day to day, but over years it's big. So yeah, okay, when you're in high school and you ran well, you're at this weight, you're not the same. Your skeleton weighs a different amount. Your liver weighs a different amount. All those things weigh a different amount, right? So the scale is just a really coarse instrument as well. I just don't think it's that helpful. We've got a, you know, one of the blogs on Super Sapiens is about, I think it's called The Fallacy of Race Weight. And if you look in there, you'll see my weight data. And I tracked it pretty much every day for like 2 months or something like that. And you can see the fluctuations. And, you know, these are probably glycogen and as a result, some fluid as well. But it's like some of that can be pretty disheartening. So I think you've got to be understanding of what you're going to do with that data if you're going to track it. But I just think the scale is a really coarse tool that is probably overused and not as helpful as it could be. The people who know in this space usually suggest to me that, not to me directly, but they suggest that you weigh yourself however much, however frequently you want to do it, and try and standardize that as much as possible, and then use monthly averages. And that should tell you enough about how coarse a tool it is. Right. If you can't see any signal in a day-to-day or a week-to-week variance and it has to be at a month level, then it's very noisy data.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And yeah, I've almost stopped, not completely stopped using it, but use it very, I guess the mistake that I'm doing is that I have a standardized weight and it's always in the morning, but I don't have a standardized that, oh, I do it the first 3 days of every month or something like that. That could be maybe smart to do, or the first 5 days of every month, and then you just use that. But yeah, it's just very irregular, and so I don't really know my weight now, or I don't know it as well as I used to anyway when I was tracking it more regularly, and I don't feel like I'm missing any information that I really need to know.
Well, so, what's it gonna change? I think you've had someone. I think you had somebody on it. It might have been on your podcast with the guy sort of. he sort of said, like, what's it going to make you feel if you get on it, it says a different number, and what's it going to make you change? Yeah. But even if that's not the case, I think for endurance athletes, I would say you need to standardize it, but you probably need to standardize it around training as well. Because I'll tell you now, if you've used a bunch of glycogen, it's going to take you some time to really replenish that, because most people aren't going to replenish that over a 24-hour window. So if it's the day after a long training block, it's probably going to be lighter. And then, you know, if you happen to weigh the first day of next month, if you're doing the first day of the month, if the first day of the next month is after a rest day, then it's going to look different. So Understand in context of training as well. So time of the day, bowel movements, bladder, but then also training weeks and that sort of stuff. So, you know, that in my perfect world, if I was given, you know, if I was SAR for a day or whatever and given a magic wand to wave, everyone would get weighed every day and no one would see any of that data. And we would just report on roughly big trends like, hey, you're trending down or you're trending up. And we would also have ideas around muscle mass as well. Because this is the elephant in the room, is body composition can change and weight can stay the same. So yeah. I think it's a course tool.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. There was one other thing that I was going to say. Oh, yeah. So when you talked about people saying that, oh, my ideal race weight is X because I used to run some fast times. What often happens, I feel, again, just coaching experience, is that an athlete can come to me and say that, oh, yeah, I used to run this time for a 5K or for a marathon, but I was this weight. It was 3 kilos lighter or whatever it is. But then I got injured and now I'm a bit heavier. So now I need to get back. Well, maybe these are not unrelated incidents. Maybe there is some correlation there as well between getting injured and the weight. So maybe it shouldn't be seen as automatic that you need to get back to your lightest weight before you got injured when you ran some fast times. Maybe it's more about, again, focusing on being injury free first, as we kind of started the podcast talking about.
I think There's actually a paper on this. I'll send it to you to put in the show notes here. But I've skimmed it recently, but long and the short of it is there's actually a positive adaptation. This is part of the problem that we see with Red S and why it probably is such a big deal, is there's actually a period of time where you do perform better when you're under fueling and your body composition is changing and you can perform for a period of time, and evolutionarily this makes some sense. Although I don't like the naturalistic explanations of things, it does make some sense. Is when there's a period of low food, you do need to be able to perform for a period of time, but then eventually you do end up injured, right? And that's exactly what you're seeing, and exactly what's happening is you go through a period where you are seeing a little bit of a benefit, and then all of a sudden, okay, now you have a problem. Now you have a bone stress injury. Now you have to take time off. And then the rebound from that's often hard for lots of reasons, psychological, emotional, trusting your body, all that stuff. So yeah, it's just a fool's errand, right? We've got to keep in context what we're training for. And for most people on some level, that's health, and health isn't about being underfueled.
Yeah, no, for sure not. So let's take one more question before the rapid fire questions. And that is about strength and conditioning, concurrent training for endurance athletes. We've talked about this a little bit. You have some thoughts on what the evolution and the future of strength and conditioning for endurance athletes and runners in particular, I guess, might look like. So what are those thoughts?
Yeah, I think, look, much to my dismay, I don't think strength training is going to be as big a deal in the future for runners. I think we're just seeing too many runners succeed without a great deal of it. And I say much to my dismay because I love it. There's nothing I love more than spending time in the gym with a barbell in hand. So I drink that Kool-Aid, so to speak. But I think if I was to future cast and looking at the current state of the trends, information, that sort of stuff, and thinking about the trickle from team sports and what they look like into non-team sports and some of the stuff I'm seeing at institutes and of sport or whatever, I think what we're going to end up with is we're already probably leaning towards more plyometrics than although there is still some heavy strength training, but I think we're going to see more plyometric emphasis, and then we're going to see an emphasis on isometrics. Particularly, there's a guy called Alex Natera who does a bunch of what he calls run-specific isometrics. Really interesting stuff. There's some cool stuff on Sportsmith about it. But in short, if you think about what we're trying to train, a lot of the time it's not so much the muscle as much as it is the tendon, and isometrics and plyometrics function around that structure a lot more. I also think that particularly isometrics are not very taxing for the body, and so recovery off the back of them is a lot easier, and so training load around modification of that isn't as big a deal. So I think isometrics are going to be a big portion of this, and this isn't, hey, I'm standing on the edge of the step and holding myself up there. It's no, I'm pushing as hard as I can against an immovable object. So it looks a bit different to what people are used to as well. And then I think we're probably going to start to see the use of more blood flow restriction training. And I think there's some cool uses here. I mean, the research is in its infancy. although it is quite old, I think for an athletic population, it's in a bit more of its infancy and our understanding of it. But I think we'll start to see some more of this, particularly at the moment, it's going to be used to come back from injury. But I think in the medium to long term, there may be a role for low intensity training with blood flow restriction and perhaps some peripheral adaptations that we're not otherwise used to, and trying to augment some of that, particularly maybe in people who are perhaps transitioning sports or who are maybe not as peripherally efficient, so to speak, or maybe that's their rate limiter is more peripheral and central adaptations, perhaps have a big VO2 max and a less good economy, so to speak.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And then let's move into the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
So I'm not going to say Endure, although I do love the book. If you are interested in a book on running that is great, I would recommend The Perfect Mile. It's a story about the first time the 4-minute mile was run. So definitely have a look at that from more of a storytelling perspective. But in terms of true training, probably showing my strength and conditioning roots here, there's a book called Super Training. It's by Mel Siff and Yuri Verkhoshansky. And it's just unbelievable from a understanding of the body and adaptation timelines and application of stimulus and periodization and all that stuff, right? So it's not as much about endurance training. It's more strength training, but there is some endurance in there. And I think many endurance coaches would gain a lot from reading the book. And it is not an easy read, I would say, though.
It has been mentioned before, but it has been a while ago. So it's good to bring that one up again.
I might have heard that. It seemed a bit familiar. But anyway, I'm stoked to hear that someone else has mentioned it.
Yeah. What's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably discipline and consistency, like that sort of combination. It's a comment I get from many people, be it that it's meticulous with my loading or something else, but it's that consistency. I think it's probably the thing for me. So, yeah.
That's a good one. And who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
Jeez, there's a lot here. I'm going to go with So Bruce Lee for his philosophy. So his absorb what's useful, discard what's not, and and make it uniquely your own. I think that sort of speaks to me from the way I think about coaching, perhaps. And then Kilian Jornet, just from his self experimentation and his engagement in his own training. I think as a coach, looking at that, thinking about an athlete, that's sort of something I really enjoy, is like how engaged he is in that process. And obviously he's self-coached, but I think that sort of thing it speaks to me in terms of wanting to find out about your own body and self-experimentation. And this is a lot of why I train now is trying to learn and trying to then bring that to other people, I suppose.
Yeah, that's great. And finally, where can people find you and mention your podcast again so they can have a look, check those out?
Yeah, as you sort of well said, so the Super Sapiens podcast, I know you listen every now and again, I get a text from you, so thank you for that, Michael. So of course, Super Sapiens podcast, we've got some guests on there, talk a little bit about continuous glucose monitors and as well. Pro Running News podcast, as I said, those are both on podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, etc. I'm on Instagram, if you want to come follow me there. Mostly at the moment, it's stories about my French bulldog and then the occasional photo of a race bib. So that's DLittman5. I'm on Twitter. I retweet a little bit, engage a little bit there, although I tend to censor myself quite a bit. So that's DJ_Lippmann. Sorry, it's on X now, not on Twitter. I mean, otherwise, yeah, I mean, you can follow me on Strava if you're that interested, but it's not super exciting. And I'm coming back. So yeah, acute injury, not a chronic one, just for the record.
Yeah, that's a good clarification. Yeah. And I know on Twitter, there are sometimes some drafts being written that are not being published.
Oh, yeah. my response or tweet or whatever, X is whatever they're called now, to actual drafting ratio is probably like 1:99. I don't do a lot there. And sometimes I'll just DM people a response because I think we're in a challenging time where things are taken out of context quickly and people's opinions are not well received in good faith. So I tend to not. So you're welcome to send me, reach out to me. My DMs are open on all those things if you want to talk and I can share my email or whatever. So happy to have those discussions in a respectful way where we're trying to, I guess, I am happy to discuss things with people. I'm not happy to argue with people. Now, if we both turn up with our respective opinions, want to hear each other and are open to changing our minds, I'm happy to have that discussion. When we both turn up with our opinions, we yell at each other and we're never going to change our minds. That's an argument. I'm not really there anymore. I don't have the time for it. So happy to discuss things with people. I won't argue with them though.
Yeah. Well, that's why I like to discuss with you about things that I'm thinking about. And yeah, you're really great at discussing topics.
And I've learned a ton from you as well. So I appreciate you both for the podcast and on the podcast, but also just in general. So I think, we can all learn a lot from each other. So we should be trying to do more of that and spending more time asking, what if I'm wrong, rather than convincing ourselves that we were right.
Yeah, totally. Okay, thank you so much, Dave.
And thank you.
Hope to talk to you again soon.
Talk soon.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes for this episode on scientifictriathlon.com with all of the relevant links that we mentioned. Do check out Dave's podcast, both the Super Sapiens podcast and Pro Running News. There are some great episodes on both of those podcasts. So they are podcasts that I regularly tune into, both of them. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and level up to achieve your next goal, there's probably no single better thing that you can do than to get some expert help along the way. And at Scientific Triathlon, we provide coaching services that cater to every need from beginners to professionals, where the athlete is in the center, the coaching is grounded in communication and individualization, and the coaches all have a wealth of experience, knowledge, and coaching skills. If coaching is out of your budget or not for you, then we also have ready-made training plans for different athlete levels and goal events, and hundreds, if not thousands of athletes have already set big PBs and reached new performance levels with these plans. They also have exchange and or money back guarantees, so it's a risk-free investment. You can find out all about our coaching, training plans, customized training plans, and consultation options on scientifictriathlon.com. And to discuss your options, you can email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis. Use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goggles. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. Even if you have just 15 minutes at home available, you can get a time-efficient Senate workout done at home that will help you swim better and stronger. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order at senatesimcare.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.